This month, Tynwald was perhaps the most emotionally charged sitting for a generation, from Rob Collister's sacking, drag queens, housing, road tax and a culture of fear in the civil service, through to sharing the load in relation to public toilets. It's fair to say we had the full range of Manx political discourse. What did the Chief Minister make of it all? Was Kerry Sharp right to raise concerns? Was Mr. Speaker content with Chris Thomas's answers? We'll hear from the Chief Minister in the second half of the programme, but first, Kerry Sharp MLC made some interesting comments about civil servants during the debate about the Cabinet Office plan.
Yeah, I think it's no secret that we have what could be called a negative culture in the civil service, and this has been noted in the past on numerous occasions. And I think part of the problem is that the civil service is always very much viewed as a bit like a rock formation with all these different sort of bands of pay and responsibility. And civil servants are always aware of who's above them and who's below them. And they're very much afraid of speaking out of line. And I have heard officers say, I couldn't possibly comment on that, or that's not my role to comment on that. And I even had one officer say to me very recently, well, I brought up what I thought was a really good point, but because I was, you know, being slightly challenging about that, I was told that there was a black mark put against my name. So people aren't going to speak out, and I think that that's a terrible shame, because if you think about it, government is the largest employer on the island. So the majority then of people who are employed find that they're effectively gagged, you know, and so government is losing out on a lot of really good ideas and contributions.
Do you think the this government, more than any other government, has a plan to try and overcome that particular issue?
Well, I think, looking at this plan that's before us today, the Cabinet Office plan, I feel hopeful in that in the way that it's laid out, it's really, really simple and straightforward, and you can see that there's a clarity of thought there, which perhaps hasn't been there before when you read government documents, you know. I think, as Mr. Henderson just said now on the floor of Tynwald, there's no waffle in it. So it lays out very clearly what Cabinet Office does, what its responsibilities are, and what it's trying to do. It mentions that performance management is going to be seriously looked at, because I think in the past it's never really been taken seriously. And so you have managers who either can't manage or who've never been trained to manage. And so you get these low levels of dissatisfaction and high levels of staff turnover. And I mean, this is no secret. You've only got to look at the Government Have Your Say surveys, which, by the way, I'm told a lot of civil servants don't fill out these online surveys because they're paranoid that people are going to read their responses, which kind of says it all, really, about, you know, how paranoid people feel. But there are low responses there. The other thing that gives me heart is that Cabinet Office is starting with a proper review into the Office of Human Resources. And I mean, this sits at the core of government. If you look at the Have Your Say responses from the officers in Office of Human Resources to questions such as, do you feel supported? How satisfied are you with your job? The levels of feedback are really, really low. I mean, so if the Office of Human Resources doesn't understand what a good working environment looks like, how is it ever going to support the rest of government? So I think that Cabinet Office is right. If you start with the Office of Human Resources, and if you get that working properly, then that should have a ripple out effect.
Do you think Tynwald bears any of the blame for this? You know, officers basically thinking, maybe their senior officers thinking, actually, do you know what, I'd rather not take a risk on this. I'd rather keep a lid on a particular problem, because we know that if it gets onto the floor of Tynwald, we're going to get hammered for it.
Well, that's a good question. I think, well, what I'd go back to is what the former president of Tim Ward, Steve Roden, used to say in terms of argument, that you should never make it personal, that, you know, you can have differences of opinion, you can discuss things, but you should never actually make it personal. So I think on the floor of Tim Ward, we should always be talking about, well, you know, did something go wrong here? What went wrong? How can we make that better? How can we not make the same mistakes again? And then it's not down to individual officers necessarily. It's down to all of us to take responsibility. You don't want to blame culture, that's for sure. You don't get anywhere. I mean, I sat on the select committee into whistleblowing in the last administration, and I was really surprised by a lot of civil servants who came forward to talk to the committee, you know, civil servants who'd had to come through the back door of Tim Ward because they were paranoid that anyone would see them even coming to give evidence, you know, before the committee. I think we have to encourage an environment where people aren't afraid to express their thoughts and where people aren't afraid to admit when things have gone wrong. Because, you know, if people are quick to admit, oh, I made a mistake, something went wrong, it can be rectified.
Mr. Speaker asked some questions about a consultation on private rental standards. He tells us why.
Well, as you know, the Landlord and Tenant Registration Bill was passed in the last administration. Here we are 18 months into this administration and not so much as a whiff of a consultation on the standards that admittedly were controversial at the time, but a first draft has been prepared that we'd seen before, but yet no inkling as to when it's going to go out. So I perhaps was just questioning the drive of government to deliver this bill into reality.
The minister referred to it being in his work stack, which didn't sound too promising.
No, it didn't. And, you know, it's always a bit Byzantine to work out what the priorities are for a minister for infrastructure. But, you know, we've recognised that housing is one of the top priorities for this government. We set up an institution, the Housing Communities Board, to actually go and deliver on the promises of housing. And yet here we are with some pretty key legislation that's there to protect people who are at the lowest end of the income spectrum from the few road landlords that are out there, and we're just not delivering it.
Obviously, you mentioned there about priorities, and indeed the everyone in Tynwald appears to see housing as a priority. Do you think the budget and the resource that's given to the Housing and Communities Board and associated areas of government is sufficient to undertake these tasks?
I'm not entirely convinced that it is, but that's not something we're hearing as a defence for not delivering on it. It's not something that sits within the core of government, and I think that has been a mistake from day one with this, that if housing is so key and core to the centre of delivering our island plan, then it should be business as usual for council ministers to deliver it, not sticking it at a body at arm's length from government. So I think these are structural issues, these are budget issues, and these are priority issues. But ultimately, the people who are feeling this are out there in damp houses around the Isle of Man.
Are you at all reassured by the minister's answer?
No.
Clearly, Mr. Speaker was unimpressed with the minister's answer, so what does Minister Chris Thomas think? You had a question from Mr. Speaker in relation to housing, which I thought was quite an important question, because, you know, this government's planning to bring in another 15,000 people to the island. The people who live here already are saying that they have significant problems in getting housing, and in a number of cases the standard of housing in the private rental market is not as good as it should be. And yet your answer was it's in our work stack.
Not quite. The Island Plan objective is that by 2026, the end of the administration, we'll have 1,000 additional homes occupied. It doesn't say we'll have 1,000 new homes built, as it sometimes gets cited. It says 1,000 homes occupied. So bringing back into use vacant properties is very important. We're just about to recruit an empty properties officer to start working with people to find out and to help why their properties are not being lived in and to help them make them lived in. And minimum standards is something that goes alongside that. Inside the Landlord Registration Private Housing Act, we have to specify standards that will be applied to these registered landlords, and then we have to think about how we enhance those standards. You and I worked together in 2014 to 2017 on the Houses and Multiple Occupation Flats regulations with the Fire Service and with DEFA, and that's what needs to happen now. We first of all need to specify the standards, and then we need to think about how we enhance them in respect of climate change initiatives and various other things. And basically, if we specify those standards too high, too quickly, more houses will become vacant because more and more let properties won't be available, and that's the big worry in the market. And I'm often being told that people are selling private rented properties because they're frightened of these standards. So where we are is that we are making good progress on bringing vacant properties back into use in all sorts of ways, and the second year's action plan for housing communities will be very much focused on that, additionally to things like dealing with homelessness and new houses and key workers and the things that we've been working on up to now.
We've had this conversation about housing being a key or possibly the main priority cited by MHK candidates and those who were successful at the last election. I asked Mr. Speaker this question, and he was pretty clear on his view. But I'll ask you: is the Housing and Communities Board resourced properly and adequately to deal with what seems to be the highest, if not one of the highest, policy objectives of the government?
Well, it sounds like Mr. Speaker might not have thought it was. We have a £3 million fund that we can apply for. We haven't used much of that as yet. We need to, and people inside the public service and using public funds are going to have to spend a lot more if they want to do something serious about bringing those vacant properties into use. As we specify higher standards, you know, we will need probably to help people meet those higher standards, and that's going to cost tens of millions. It costs £25 million to build 100 houses, basically, around £25 million to build around 100 houses. So it's an expensive business. That can either come from the private sector or the public sector, or there could be a way in between. And it's the way in between that I'm most excited about, and I think the Housing Communities Board is. So we're looking to work between the public sector and the private sector, bringing forward what we call mid-rents, but also working to help private people bring their houses back into use when they have been vacant. And that's why it's so important. I really appreciated the question from Mr. Speaker today. I didn't think he went far enough in his answering his supplementaries. I was disappointed I wasn't able to get more information out, but we'll do that in coming weeks and months.
It is fair to say that he wasn't particularly satisfied with the answers that he was given. That was certainly the indication he gave to us.
Well, I'll listen to, I haven't heard what he said, and I'm intrigued to know how he misunderstands.
So then the other two questions could be described as very, very much local constituency issues. One was in relation to the incident with the train and the tree at Ballabeg station. The other in relation to the toilet block in Castletown, which, as I understood it, Castletown commissioners gave up the use of the toilet block and then complained that it was short. Was that how it worked?
Well, yeah, but let history, let bygones be bygones. That is what happened. They had a lease between 1999 and 1st of December 2022, which they engaged a lawyer to give up, and then delighted that they've now taken on a licence for 12 months to work with Department of Infrastructure to transfer those toilets, with a covenant that they have to remain as toilets, most likely, such that they can fulfil their exciting ambitions to support Manx National Heritage with its tourist sites, perhaps the buses. But basically, there's a buzz about Castletown. They're doing bold things with the Market Square. And at the end of the day, if you've got a vibrant community of visitors and locals, you're going to need public toilet facilities. I'm very pleased to work with the commissioners. We get £5 a year originally in 99 for the lease on those public toilets. toilets in Castletown. I think it's gone up with rent reviews every 3 years to nearly £10. It's not a huge amount of money. It doesn't justify a huge amount of money expended by the Harbours Division because there are other toilets in the harbours. But I'd love to work with other commissioners to see whether something equally ambitious and bold as what Castletown is doing in other places.
This is a local authority responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah, perhaps it should be more, but we do. I just checked through the leases database back in the DOI, and we are getting small amounts of peppercorn rents for quite a few public toilets. Obviously, the department is always going to provide public toilet facilities in all the public buildings, like schools and terminals and tax offices and all the other parts of the public estate. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be working with local authorities for public toilet facilities. And I would say that Manx National Heritage, Department for Enterprise, the bus van in, have all got an important part in that. And we should be planning these things. Let's link it in.
And then in relation to the train, though he was agitating to have any tree within any falling distance of a highway or a railway to be removed. Is that how you saw it?
And that is how I perceived it. I say I was in the control room that evening. I just walked in, was there because night buses were running and I thought there might be a little bit of an issue. I wanted to show support. When I got there, the tree had just fallen down and the train was blocked. I heard the end of the conversation with the officer who could bring out people to chop away the tree. Damage was assessed, the train went on its way. The question today was able to give the information that we had assessed the trees and we'd asked for permission to fell some trees because obviously elms, ash, they're all affected by forces of nature. And our primary responsibility, whether it be on the railways or on the highways or around public buildings, is to make sure that safety is assured. And we will have to chop down trees that are dangerous to trains or dangerous to cars or dangerous potentially to people in any way. We haven't got very much money. We're going to have to work imaginatively with the landowners who are responsible for the trees on their land, and I'll be announcing and engaging about that very proposal in coming months.
Is there a risk that we will, at a time that we need to be planting more trees, end up with the island's roadsides and tracksides denuded of any significant trees?
Well, no, but some trees will have to go from beside the roads and beside the railways. I mean, buses do lose wing mirrors and top deck windows from trees that are hanging down, and we will have to deal with them. There are 4,000 or so, or thereabouts, ash around the strategic highways of the island that have suffered from ash dieback. We'll have to do something about all of these things, but you make a very good point. I'm intrigued to see what the Glen Helen section of road will look like after trees have been chopped back around it, and trees are precious for all sorts of reasons, if only for the visual amenity, but also for much, much more, and we've got to balance these things.
To be fair, though, the Glen Helen section, I heard the department saying that they were replanting, mm-hmm. But possibly with trees that aren't quite so big and quite so much likely to damage vehicles if they did fall.
Yeah, and that's an important point. But I just want to make sure you heard me properly, which is that ultimately the Department of Infrastructure around the highways network has got a duty, has got certain duties to make sure it's doing its job properly. But the trees themselves are on landowners' responsibility. So, we've got to think through how we can use the public resources that we've got working with those landowners to make sure that we fulfil our duties and that they fulfil their duties as well. As I heard when we went round the regional meetings talking about the new highways charter and how that might be implemented in the future, when is a tree a hedge and when is a hedge a tree? That's a bit vague and it's interpreted differently in different parts of the island. That's why we've got this detailed engagement going on. What we're focusing on first are the standards around when is a tree part of a hedge and when is it a standalone tree. Is it the owner responsible? Is it the local authority? Is it the DOI? We're also looking at ditches. What you do with the debris from trimming branches and other work on hedges and trees. Gullies and what the impact is on gullies of stuff that comes from the trees in storms and more generally what time of year that we should be focusing on it. And that's why I'm so delighted the DOI is working together with most of the local authorities to actually put together the standards, and then later on we'll work out how this needs to be organised and who should pay for it. But I certainly want to remind people that ultimately we've got to bring the landowners into this as well.
That was Infrastructure Minister Chris Thomas. Chief Minister Alf Cannon was unwell, so missed Tuesday's eventful Tynwald sitting. What did he make of the highly charged debate in relation to Rob Collister's sacking?
Well, they're always tough on people. It's been an unfortunate set of circumstances and events. You know, to me, these events are important, but often can serve ultimately to be a distraction for politicians and for the public from the real day-to-day business. In this case of delivering proper quality healthcare to our community, continuing to develop our health service. Look, you know, everybody involved, including myself, comes in with the intent of delivering the very best we can in terms of our skills and abilities to be able to make sure that government is working efficiently and effectively and achieving various political aims and objectives. And sometimes that those come into conflict or don't work so well in certain circumstances. You know, I think an investigation's had to be undertaken. Rob's apologised now. He's a very passionate man. He's a very passionate constituency man. I have no problems with that. It's just been an unfortunate set of circumstances. I think, you know, we should take as usual the lessons from that. And we need to move on. We need to get back to focusing on the real issues that are impacting on people and getting our, you know, health service back up to delivering the levels of service and care that we want it to. And of course, functioning, you know, focusing on the other areas of service delivery across government.
The health minister, the current health minister, made very clear that staff are too scared to use the processes that are available to them by way of making complaints. They're scared. I mean, he seemed at one point to imply that the departures of several senior officers from government during the first year of your administration had led to a level of fear. Is that something you recognise, and how is that going to be addressed?
Well, I think actually, you know, my view, and as you know, unfortunately, I couldn't be in the Tynwald sitting because I was ill. You know, I listened intently to the debate, and my view was that the health minister actually was talking generically about the right of civil servants to have their identities protected when these types of reports and investigations are being delivered. And I fundamentally, in principle, support that. And there clearly may be times when actually it is appropriate, but under the whistleblowing code, generally you will try to ensure that people are properly protected. So that's, I think it was more on a more generic basis. And I don't think you just want to take one incident and try and portray that as a big issue, you know, across government. You know, we've had clear indicators of a number of personnel, human resources type, management type issues that needed to be addressed on the back of the Roslyn Ranson affair. We're doing that. That's why you know, we'll be shortly coming back with some recommendations about how we conduct human resources. We've already announced changes to how some of the approach should differ in terms of senior level management approach, what options and opportunities there are. We're going to put in place this operations performance board, for example. And, you know, we generally try and improve and seek to improve the workplace for everybody. And, you know, clearly the relationship between civil servants, the civil service, the public service and politicians is a fundamentally important part of that. And you know, one of the reasons why this has become an independent investigation is because of that, you know, some of the implications that came about. But fundamentally, it's been a parliamentary investigation into and surrounding political behaviours in a certain environment. And we've apologised and moved on, and we need to get back to the business of governing and delivering the services now.
And I suppose the only fear that people may have is that if this whole enterprise exercise has resulted in senior officers feeling too scared to actually question civil service. We also heard actually from one member during, I forget which debate it was, that she had been told by a civil servant that they had a black mark against their name because they dared to raise an issue, which was a clear concern for the area they were working in. And they were effectively then told that they shouldn't have raised it. It wasn't for them to do. Is this a generic thing, or is this just hopefully? I'm sure I know what you're going to say. Hopefully, a one-off situation.
Clearly, one needs to understand the particular circumstances. And listen, I mean, I think sometimes, you know, political will differs from the opinion of senior officers. And, you know, certainly, you know, specifically in my time in Treasury, I feel there were probably multiple occasions when senior officers and the politicians disagreed. But, you know, I hope those debates were conducted in a transparent and professional manner. And occasionally, you know, we noted down specific objections and recorded those accordingly. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, there will not be cases when people disagree. And what we need to be sure and confident of is that those cases can be managed professionally, properly, and those debates can happen, and that people can leave the room feeling that, you know, their reputation's intact and that they will continue to be able to undertake their work properly and professionally. And it's really about process, Phil. This is about process. This is about a proper professional approach, about professional understanding and a recognition that healthy, strong debate is proper and appropriate, and that we should have proper processes. If people object, fair enough. If that gets overridden, that's absolutely fair as well. But in the context, that should be done in a basis of absolutely mutual respect. And certainly, you know, from my own perspective, and I'm sure within the Council of Ministers, absolutely encourage proper debate and challenge where appropriate. And of course, you know, ultimately, the politicians will, I hope, in the right circumstances, make that decision. Even if that is against an officer's will, then moves on to a different case of sort of behaviour of standards and professionalism and off the cuff remarks and what's being said out of context and outside of sort of, if you like, professional environments such as meetings. There's a lot to consider, but as I said, you just take one incident, and I don't necessarily believe that to be reflective across government at all.
One of the things that I think most commentators would say is that government really did appear to have shot itself in the foot in relation to the drag queen incident at the QE2 school. Do you regret the way in which government's handled this? Could it have been handled better, do you think?
I don't regret it at all. I think the minister has pursued exactly the right course of action and has sought to clarify the facts. If the minister had reacted immediately without full and proper clarification and understanding, and either had misquoted something or quoted something out of context, that itself would have been a headline, and would have been held against her at a later date. The way that's been handled in terms of producing the actual facts, I appreciate it's taken a while, but nevertheless, it's absolutely vital. It's a very serious matter, and we take it extremely seriously, but we needed facts. It's clearly complicated by the fact that the individual who is effectively at the heart of this happens in their spare time, as I understand it, to be a drag artist. But this was clearly being confused by the fact that the specific allegations were that they conducted a lesson in drag, and then obviously needed to get complete clarification around comments that were made specifically about a pupil being thrown out of a lesson for remarks made to the person who was taking the lesson. And again, it was net not that clear from all the reports that were coming into the minister, exactly what had happened. So it's handled in the right way. The next stage of the investigation and the proper stage, really, in the heart of this whole issue, is to understand the age appropriateness and the content of the curriculum. And unfortunately, Phil, that is just not by itself easy. My understanding is that the curriculum that is set, the way that it is interpreted and delivered, can be quite subjective. We need to get to the bottom of that, and we need to have a very frank understanding of the content, the way it's been delivered, and the age, absolutely the age appropriateness of this, and also how and when parents are properly engaged and have full knowledge of what has been shown and delivered to their children.
Some of the extravagant headlines that have been created in the Isle of Man's name could have been avoided. Within a week, it would have been obvious about some of the basic facts that have been misquoted. It just seems to most people that waiting 4 or 5 months to get the answers, it seems like an awfully long time.
Well, it hasn't been 4 or 5 months. I mean, it's been a couple of weeks, effectively. It may seem like 4 or 5 months, okay. But it's actually been a few weeks. If you're talking about the bigger issues around the curriculum, as I said to you, I think that we need to get proper understanding both of how this curriculum's been introduced, the context of what was being delivered before, how teachers are being engaged in terms of their understanding of what needs to be done in terms of delivery, and also the actual age grade content of this and the appropriateness of that for the children, and how that has been managed and monitored. And there's actually quite a lot of information there. And I think we need to get that information independently, because, you know, there's a lot at stake emotively, emotionally, professionally. And that's, I'm afraid, why this is going to take another few months to sort out, and why actually the minister was right to pause the sex education curriculum in order to get a proper understanding of what is going on. And I'm particularly interested to know, not only what is in that curriculum, but what else has been brought into that, or sorry, whether any other third party literature or videos have been brought into that outside of the official curriculum, if you like. So there's a lot to do, Phil. It's right to pause it. What we also mustn't forget, there's really important GCSEs and A-levels that are taking place in a matter of weeks' time. There's a raft of children coming behind those immediate age groups who will also be taking GCSE and A-levels next year. And we've got to make sure that we're properly focused on delivering the curriculum. Again, I'm sure RHSE is important, of course it is. But, you know, fundamentally, what's going to count most in people's lives is the quality of their exam grades and their exam results. And let's get back to focusing on that. We'll sort this out, I hope, over the summer. And so by September the next year, we will be in a much, much better position.
In relation, well, only today, we're recording this on Thursday, the Chamber of Commerce have released some figures which shows that in the first quarter of this year, businesses are, to say the least, worried. They are concerned at significant inflationary pressures, partly as a result of increased salary costs, partly as a result of the increase in the minimum wage, also other inflationary costs, but particularly energy costs. There's also more than half of the population of the people surveyed suggesting that housing is a serious problem relating to their ability to recruit. I mean, we heard a little exchange in Tynwald, questions with the Speaker and the Chair of the Housing Board, Minister for Housing, Chris Thomas, I think both conceded that perhaps there isn't enough funding going into the housing side of things. Do you think government has got its priorities right with this? The budget, when it was being debated, there didn't seem to be an awful lot of concern about the significant budgetary pressures everyone outside of government was facing. A lot of money obviously being spent internally. Do you think government's got the right balance here?
Well, so you've raised a whole host of issues there. Let's deal with the economy first, because you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, there's significant pressures, not just on businesses, but on households as well, Phil. And it is going to take a period of adjustment. Let's not forget, We immediately reacted last year to the uncertainty of the Ukraine war, the uncertainty of energy prices. We put £17 million into the economy, not just only supporting households, but also in many ways that money would have gone into the businesses as well, so that people were able to carry on with a lot of what you might term as their discretionary spend, as well as deal with some of the increased household bills that they would have faced. But fundamentally, and in freezing electricity prices in particular, another action that we undertook outside of that 70 million, another action, freezing electricity prices, of course, we added additional stability to what was looking like a hugely difficult winter. You know, particularly as we had no foresight into how the war was going to develop, had no foresight into the fluctuations in energy costs or prices, and indeed no foresight into the weather. Now, arguably, we could have released some of that brake and perhaps not gone in so hard. But nevertheless, I think what we did was took firm, decisive action, which gave us a really solid base over that whole sort of period, if you like, right up until the 1st of April, when, of course, you know, we've agreed that we cannot no longer continue to sustain, to support energy prices. And of course, part of that decision, whilst recognising that is going to be tough now for the future, also, however, goes some factors into account that decisions we make now to protect generations here on the ground today impact significantly into the future. You will have the battle scars from MUA debt. Now, arguably, that was built around slightly different scenario. But nevertheless, you will understand that incurring debt and building debt will mean that future generations have to pay it back. So at some point, you know, our society, if you like, our current sort of group of engaged people, particularly in our sort of, you know, middle ages and getting into the older generation, have to face up to the reality. And I think the reality is, you know, government finances are massively impacted. We've got huge levels of requirements for health service, particularly. We've got to look at funding in other areas. Inflation is impacting everybody. It's a pernicious thing, inflation. It affects almost every single impact of life, including government finances. But also there's the reality of, if we don't do this now, when are we going to do it? And of course, what we've seen, particularly with energy, electricity prices, yes, we protected, you know, let's just take the 22 pence per unit versus where it was in the UK at 34 pence. The fact it's going to catch that effectively, that price up over the next 6 months or so, or next 3 months, effectively 1st of April, 30%, and then 1st of June, 30%. But of course, we're paying catch up. We could have had that rise last year and been on level paying, you know, with sort of comparable partners, if you like, or benchmarks across the water. But we chose to protect our community more and our economy. So, you know, there's a lot of actions that have taken place to protect us, but sometimes you have to face up to the realities of the situation and deal with that. Then when you talk about housing, for example, we're pressing ahead with an ambitious economic program, as you know. And yes, I mean, there's still a lot of issues that need to be dealt with across the whole of government services. But housing, I believe, is one issue where we are actually making significant progress, because we set that target of 1,000 new housing units for this administration. You will have seen, actually, in the private sector, some really encouraging signs in terms of the new developments that are coming through. I'm pleased to see the Derby development, for example, that's taking place. I see there's recent planning applications in Ramsey, for example. You'll have seen what we're doing with the Manx Development Corporation. So more stock will be coming onto to the market. And, of course, we've got the Island Infrastructure Scheme, which we will see the results of very soon, which will bring more stock onto line. So actually, I'm confident that in doing that, you know, bringing more stock on will help us meet our targets in terms of the new people coming to the island. But providing we've obviously got to meet our low cost housing commitments as well within the stock that's being, or affordable housing commitments within that, we will ease some of the certainly the perceived crisis that's around, and give people the opportunity to get on the housing ladder. And of course, there's many other factors that go alongside that that we're working on in terms of whether that's planning reform or built environment reform. But actually, I think that's one area, and I intend to demonstrate that in the next few months in terms of what, by producing some real facts for people about what we're doing across all these areas of government to make sure that we are keeping pace with demand when it comes to housing.
One of the key messages that you sent out, possibly unwisely, was our target is 15,000 people. I think that possibly backfired to a certain extent, in that people were thinking, well, we can't afford to live here at the moment. What are you bringing an extra 15,000 people in, and we can't find anywhere to live? How is all that going to work? What we know is that the Isle of Man would probably have voted for Brexit. We also know that one of the core reasons people vote for Brexit was that they were concerned about levels of immigration. What you're proposing, what your government is proposing, is the equivalent of a 1.25 million increase per year of people coming into the UK. That would be the equivalent in Isle of Man terms. Do you not think that somehow there needs to be a bit more from your government and from yourself in terms of messaging to get people from where they are at the moment, which is largely thinking we don't want lots of people coming into the island, to where you are, which is if we are to have a thriving economy, we need to have more people?
Well, I don't think it's helpful just carrying out sort of country by country comparisons, because clearly both political and domestic and economic environments can vary considerably. I think it's also probably been unhelpful to have this 15,000 figure being used without the fundamental core 5,000 new jobs and 5,000 new economically active workers sitting fundamentally at the actual heart of that and being the core driver for that. Phil, and that will be our ultimate measure in terms of the success and the fundamentals in recognising why we are doing that, to address longer term problems that are forecast for society unless some of the age demographics change. And so, you know, I think what we're doing, of course, you know, fundamentally at the heart of ensuring that we have a strong and healthy society is making sure we've got a strong and healthy economy, right? One where people can earn the money and get the income and get the jobs and the job security they need to raise their families and do what they want to do and feed everybody. And of course, in doing that, the government's got its responsibility alongside of improving the infrastructure and improving the service deliveries. But, you know, one piece of the jigsaw, it's not just a nice black and white or a nice jigsaw piece that all fits together very smoothly. You know, we have to keep pushing forward the economy and driving forward for jobs and investment and opportunities. And at the same time, we've got to deliver our services as well. And they're not, you know, necessarily mutually exclusive in terms of problem solving. You know, we're constantly evolving. We have to, as a human society, by very nature, evolve. You know, our desire as a government and drive is to make the island more sustainable, both economically, but also, for the longer term. We see that being delivered by creating these new jobs, by creating more vibrant town centres, by really driving investment into the brownfield sites. And I think, actually, I know in one of the quirks of our political system is that we come in as independents and form effectively what is the national manifesto after elections. But, you know, the vast majority of Tynwald support the way direction we're going. When I talk to my constituents, of course there's some concern, but there's also a lot of support for ensuring that we've got a strong economy for the future, that we're delivering the jobs for the future, that government's going to get its revenue for the future, that we're modernising our energy sustainability and security for the future. So Yes, and in these transitional periods, Phil, and I really do regard this as a significant transitional period, and government's got a lot of catching up to do, particularly when it comes to energy and renewables, as you know, and also in things like digitalisation, for example, and we've highlighted that as a critical area and an area which should provide efficiency and productivity. And of course, we see now the rapid, I think, movement in AI and access to artificial intelligence. So we're hugely transitional, fast-paced environment in which we're working. And of course, there's going to be concern, particularly as an island that's normally been a very sort of staid, secure island in a slow-moving approach. Actually, we are seeking a much more dynamic approach to solving some of these problems and moving a lot faster, particularly when it comes to sort of infrastructure, if you like, the way the island looks, and what is being done to absolutely, you know, secure the future for jobs and the economy.
Final question then, because I know you have to go to another meeting. The International Panel on Climate Change has just reported, and reading between the lines, they're basically saying we're not, as a global society, we're not taking sufficient action to limit the ravages of climate change. There have been some announcements of things that are eventually going to happen in relation to climate change from this government, but we are now a quarter of the way through this administration's term, and we ended up with one of the, I think it was the final item on the Timbald Order paper, was the bureaucracy that we've created is a little bit too onerous, so we'll alter the bureaucracy. Isn't it time we started seeing something more than form filling and paperwork, and actually started to see some real incentives for people to make the changes that would have insulated themselves from many of the energy problems that we're currently facing?
Well, I think we are making progress. I think the critical problem for government actually to solve, Phil, is energy provision. And that by itself will ease, as you know, a considerable burden from our climate change emissions, which of course are an absolute fraction. But nevertheless, we know the importance. It's not just for us, of course, the environment is fundamentally important, absolutely. But now we're also being driven by business requirements, community requirements, advances in technology. So we're on course. So we've set that target now. We are firm about onshore renewable provision, because we know we can achieve that, and we will have to face up to the realities of delivering that. And we've set the target of 2026, and we know that we can probably get up to 30 megawatts of onshore renewable provision onto the grid. We have also, you know, at the moment, just working out the finalities of our absolute energy policy, and we need to be clearer with the community and business as well what that actually means, and you know, actually, yes, parts of this are perhaps moving more slowly, but for example, we know that from 2025 or possibly 2024, but probably 2025, you know, we're not allowing gas boilers to be put into new builds. So things are happening. Of course, the there are limitations as well, because we have got grant schemes available, Green Living Grant schemes available. Of course, there's been a number of applications. The processing administration of that can be slow, but of course, the availability of workers to deliver that also is slow. And when people are talking about air source heat pumps and installing that, we've also got to get the workforce up to speed when it comes to those areas as well. So, you know, this does require some continued thought process. It's also an evolution, but I can tell you that we have now got clarity in terms of that energy commitment. We put our targets into legislation, and I think what you will find is that we'll gather more and more pace from an island perspective. And I feel that a lot of people will feel more confident when they know that renewable energy is actually on the grid and we're producing it ourselves, and that will be a major step forward. And I think we have forced that issue by determining the policy. And I can tell you, Councillor Ministers is working very closely with the Manx Utilities Authority to make sure that they're going to deliver on this.
Well, Chief Minister, if you have any frustrations at the pace of change, you're doing very well in hiding them. Thank you very much for sparing the time.
That's a pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
That was Chief Minister Alf Cannon, MHK. Lots to ponder in this week's programme. Has government got things right? Is there a culture of fear in the civil service? Is government sufficiently supportive of our local economy? So many questions and so little time. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting philgorn@manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, though, I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayo. Thanks for listening.